But despite denials all around, there is also no question that what we have here is organizational chaos. And the key to success for the Bears in 82 is whether new coach Mike Ditka can get along with the unsolicited defensive leader assigned to him by George Halas, Buddy Ryan.
There can only be one boss, and Ditka's a boss, and I'm working for him, and everything will work out fine. Because I don't have any ego problems, you know that. I mean, I do my job, and I think it's been a damn good one, and I plan on continuing to do a good job.
That Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world, they just disagree on how.
We're going to get across that wasteland, and we're going to do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
One in eight. That's how many people have worked at a McDonald's. Who'll serve millions the best Big Mac and best birthday party they've ever had. Who haven't just seen kids graduate from a Happy Meal, but have gotten help graduating themselves. Because they know the skills learned here.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to English Under the Arches.
Can por help favor, you grow average. From here or keep growing here.
Hi, welcome to
One in eight, start at McDonald's. And where you start stays with you.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap with Mike Donahue. Mike is on location in Arizona. Maybe his Wi-Fi will be better out there. I don't know. may send you out there permanently.
Right. Hey, this works.
We're going to talk today because Rob Manfred is... He told us today, spring training, it's not postponed. We're on track.
Is that what
until,
he said today?
Yeah, until tomorrow when we realize it's too late. We're going to get to baseball pretty soon, but we're going to do one more football one. And I decided, and Mike has to do it. I'm going to look back at the candidates the Bears interviewed, or at least tried to interview, for every coaching search since they hired Mike Ditka in 1982. And there are some doozies on this list. So as always, you can subscribe to the podcast. Actually, I've made it even easier. You can subscribe to the podcast at pointlessexercise.com. You can subscribe to the newsletter at pointlessexercise.com. You can go to Discipio if you want, but it's all right there for you on the page, even if you're not a subscriber, which, you know, you should be, but that's fine. And
subscribe, cowards.
All right, so 1982, the final coaching search headed up by George Halas.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. I appreciate the introduction. I want to say that I'm in Arizona, of course, to do my own recon, see what I can find out here about the viability. But I also want to add that had I not been in Arizona and back home in the the low 20 temperatures of Chicago, I would definitely be wearing my Russ Grimm sweater. But it's just too damn warm down in the desert for that.
Thanking the McClatchkeys or whatever he called. I don't know what he called. It wasn't right. So in 1982, obviously we know the Bears or George Halas hired Michael Keller Ditka,
who was his old tight end,
who was the special teams coordinator for the Cowboys. The Bears interviewed two other candidates. Actually, no, I should take that back. The Bears for sure interviewed one other candidate. The third person, insisted that George interview him, and I found conflicting reports about whether George actually bothered to have a courtesy meeting with this candidate. But can you figure out who either of those two might be?
Either of the two candidates. So if we're going into the Professor Sherman and Peabody Wayback Machine to 1982, it's kind of fun to just to like see where the Bears were at, because that would turn out to be the right hire, but it was kind of the organization was really at a low point dysfunctionally organization-wise. The fact that you're just talking about George Halas making the decision, bear in mind that at this point, George Halas, while this is going on, is 87 years old. he had, you know, really sort of been a non-factor since, winning the championship in 63. Even that was a little bit, well past his prime. And, you know, he had nominally given his son Muggs the keys, but it was still the George Halas show. I think with a comment that one league member said around 1982 was that it would be like having the Wright brothers run American Airlines. The time had, he had long been passed, but there was one decision between 63 and 82 that proved to be their only salvation. That was when Muggs, it might have been the only positive thing he did, went outside this completely insular organization that had really sort of gotten, grown some decay, and hired Jim Finks following the previous low point, at that point in 1974. To turn things around. And Finks, had some early success and then middle success and, started to wear out his welcome. And so it was kind of a weird environment. It really is a low point when you talk about the franchise, because Finks had taken him to two wild card appearances. But by this time, he had been in charge for 7 years. And he would not be around much longer, although thankfully he would stick around for the 83 draft, which really proved to put that whole plan over the top. But the backstory in 82 is that even though Finks had been the general manager and had drafted all those players like, Peyton and Avellini and Dennis Lick and, Dan Hampton, he had hired Jack Pardee and Neil Armstrong. They had both fizzled out. So time was running out for Jim Finks, and the old man, still possibly grieving the passing of the unexpected passing of his own son 2 years, 3 years earlier, came down to basically run operations at 87 and cut Jim Finks off at the knees and make a supremely, as you hinted at, Andy, a supremely sentimental type of a hire. It was also like a bit of reconciliation. Ditko, of course, was the tight end that Halas had drafted out of Pittsburgh in 61. And, he went on to eventually have a Hall of Fame career, and he was part of Halas's last championship team and, burned bridges with Halas. And so that's where the reconciliation comes in. Just weird, and it worked out, and it's the only era that we can celebrate, but it is funny to go right back to that point, and with that in mind, that Halas had his guy, and now there's another guy that he really didn't give a shit about, and someone that he supposedly considered, and I just have to say that I have absolutely no guesses without you giving me any hints as to who the other candidates were. I think Beasley was giving out the answer. Is that George?
It was actually Lucas. There's two guys, Lucas. Too many dogs.
Is George named after George Stanley Hale?
He's named after George McCaskey. Oh. I was so impressed.
Well done.
Right.
You're
absolutely right about. There's a great when I was digging up the information on these and who the candidates were for all these searches. Tribune has an article from 1982, from the day that the hiring was announced, and for some reason embedded in it is a Channel 2 report with Jeannie Morris.
Jeannie Morris.
Yes. Where she talked to Jim Finks. She didn't get to interview Jim Finks. And Jim let her know that he had instructed his agent to not negotiate an extension to his contract as general manager, because he didn't have any input in the Ditka hiring at all. He did not want Ditka, and Halas went over his head as he could.
If Finks went public with Jeannie Morris with
said
that?
He didn't want. He said he would not be.
And of course, it's a good bluff, because Halas is not going to fire him and eat that contract. Not at that age. He wouldn't do it when he was younger.
She also interviewed the in-house candidate who the Bears had interviewed.
In-house in 1982, was he on the coaching staff? Was it Buddy Ryan?
It was Buddy Ryan, and Buddy said,
"What?"
Buddy was all happy. Buddy said, it's not going to be a problem. He said, Ditka is he's called him Ditka. He didn't call him Mike or Coach Ditka. He called him Ditka.
You mean when Ditka got hired, this was Buddy's exit? Okay.
Buddy told Jeannie, it's not going to be a problem. Ditka's the coach, and I'll run the defense, and I'm sure we'll get along fine.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a parting shot right off the bat to just refer to him as Ditka. No doubt.
Yeah.
I'm surprised he didn't call him number 89.
So the other supposed candidate is a guy who comes up quite a bit on Remember This Crap. We talk about the Bears. A former assistant coach of the Bears who also had served. He coached the Bears from 1958 to 1965. He was on Halas' staffs. He was the He was the defensive coordinator and the head of player personnel when the last Bears championship in 1963. He hadn't coached in the NFL since 1978 with the Rams.
George Allen.
Yeah, he got turned down by Halas, and so he coached the next year.
For the Chicago Blitz.
And then,
oh my God!
And then the whole franchise got traded to Arizona, and he coached the Wranglers in '84, right. And that would be the last time he would coach until he was murdered dunked. By his own celebrating players
exactly.
at Long Beach State in 1990 when they dumped a Gatorade yes. bucket on an 80-year-old man
because he had rallied their perennially hapless team to like a 7-2 mark in champions.
They had
their
first
division.
Winning season in like 20 years.
Yes, George, that was 1990.
1990.
Yeah.
The Long Beach State played football in 1991, and they haven't since.
My God. Wow. Talk about.
Yes, George wow. Allen. Well, he was going to be the savior.
So let's unpack this real quick because I didn't even hardly hit on how dysfunctional it really was because you've got. So Buddy Ryan is the other guy that Halas takes seriously, where. And because that's another part of the extension here is that Halas is a condition of Ditka taking the job. And that's why Buddy was being asked about it was that Buddy had to stay. So Halas liked Buddy, just not enough to give him the job. With good reason, because Mike Ditka might not have been a better coach than a lot of people, but he was a better head coach than Buddy Ryan, as events would later bear out. But it's just funny. Then the only other two guys are these two different prodigal sons, right? That Halas had sort of, you know, burned bridges with. So, you know, they both come back with their tail between their legs, and George Allen gets told to fuck off, and yep. Ditka actually gets his redemption. So, and we're, you know, made there. Thankfully, could have gone any number of horrible ways, but actually that one went the right way.
Well, there was a lot of letter writing involved in the 1982 coaching search.
Ditka
expressed his interest to Halas in a handwritten letter that he wrote and sent to him. And then famously, the Bears defense, headed up by, if you're going to have a guy write a letter for you, have Gary Fensick write the letter. Wrote a letter to Halas asking that Buddy not be fired, that Buddy stay on to coach the defense, no matter who they hired as a coach. And Halas apparently was big into, he liked correspondence.
I didn't
know
that.
He let both people have their way. He let Ditka be the coach, and he kept Buddy as the defensive coordinator.
And even that's kind of dysfunctional, but it managed to work as much as we needed it to. So, yay. But, boy, that's an example of succeeding in spite of all of the events around you.
Yeah. So that
wow.
that haphazard way of picking a coach.
Yeah, resulted... HR would have a say today.
Yes. Right. I don't know who the Rooney Rule was not around. Although George was pretty tan, I don't think he would have counted. That resulted in the longest sustained period of Bears success since Halas' own heyday.
Yeah.
Haven't had anything close to that since. Lovey had a nice run, but it wasn't anything near
nope.
that.
No, it still stands. It's a ridiculously low bar. It's become a bit of a caricature that it is such a long-standing thing, but the fact of the matter is that it is. So,
but yeah, Fink stayed through the draft and then quit and went to go work for the Cubs.
Which was strange.
Jim Fink is in the Football Hall of Fame. He's the architect of the Purple People Eaters in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they went to 4 Super Bowls, didn't win them, but he put that team together. He was really the primary architect of the 85 Bears.
He should get most of the credit. I'll fight anybody who argues otherwise.
He got to drink scotch with Dallas Green, and
yeah,
they were
like
co-architects of the 84 Cubs. And then he came back to the NFL, and he took a moribund, awful franchise in New Orleans, and he hired Jim Mora, Sr. Junior yeah. will come up later in this podcast. And they made the playoffs. They had a first winning season in Saints history, and they made
playoffs.
The playoffs.
And the first winning season in playoffs, and so absolutely right. Three different franchises did really momentous things. So again, it just kind of brings me back to how close Finks was to just being a one and done with the Bears. But it kind of he gets credit for that, but barely. But it you know in a big way that 83 draft is really saved his ass.
Yeah, I mean
he
drafted Walter Payton.
He drafted Dan Hampton.
He drafted Jim McMahon. He drafted Dan Hampton. He was there for the 83 draft.
Yeah, Jim
most
Culver.
Most anybody worth a shit on the 85 Bears, Jim Finks was the reason they were Bears.
Right. So, right. And that's one of the greatest single seasons without any, you know, sort of parochialism.
And did you know, because I didn't know this, how close Jim Finks was to being the commissioner of the NFL?
Didn't we talk about it? I vaguely remember after Roselle and before
he was Pete Rozelle's hand-picked successor. And they thought that the vote was going to be a formality, but there were 11 relatively new owners who didn't really have opposition to Finks, but they wanted to say in the process. They didn't like the fact that Pete was just going to pick his successor, so they held it up, and he couldn't get enough votes to get voted in. And then somebody threw the electric Paul Tagliabue's name into the thing, and they went through, like, they were waiting for the white smoke over the Vatican. They had several ballots, and Tagliabue ended up being the guy who they cut a deal where Tagliabue would be the commissioner and Finks would be like the vice president of whatever for the NFL. And Finks said, fuck off, and retired.
Went into retirement,
And died of lung cancer.
Yeah, he was like much longer after that. Right. That's too bad. You know, it's fitting he's in the Hall of Fame. I'm happy about it, and I appreciate his contribution. He's pretty much one of the few good things on balance that we've had, you know, to enjoy. So there you go. So when Ditka got fired, of course, I'm just going to say this: the next thing was not a low point, but it was not a rock bottom low point, but it was a weird transition for the first time in a decade. You know, Ditka's had worn out his welcome, and it was time to start fresh. So what do you got, Andy?
So the weird thing about this is that the Bears they didn't just get their choice. Everyone told them they were geniuses, that they got the best coach on the market, and they stole him away from the Giants because the Giants needed a head coach, and they wanted Dave Wannstedt, and the Bears wanted Dave Wannstedt, and Mike McCaskey managed to get it done.
Like, I think the parallel narrative that was going on then, where after Finks gets fired, Ditka sort of suddenly had some unexpected clout, which he used to whatever extent he could. And I think he kind of helped engineer Jerry Vannesi to replace Finks until they, you know, McCaskey, for whatever reason, because he was incompetent, but he obviously didn't have the self-awareness to recognize it, that he really did have enough ego to you know how George likes to hide in the shadows and Michael did too after a while? Michael thought he was a big boy early on, and he – Ditka was in the way. Like, that fucking grandpa lived long enough to saddle us with this, and now they're succeeding, and I can't get rid of him. Well, I'm going to cut out Vannesi. And I don't think it's a narrative. I think it's true that McCaskey, you know, really did want to make that one move and do something with his mark on it, and he couldn't because Ditka was so perennially successful until he wasn't.
Yeah.
89 was a hiccup, but you can't just get rid of him right then. And, of course, Ditka's teams bounced back in 90, 91 until 92. It really did bottom out. Here was Michael McCaskey's chance, and he went by that blueprint. It actually, and by some point, a little bit of paint by numbers, but in some level, it looks like, yeah, he was doing, like, on the surface, some of the right things. We didn't know how flawed he was. None of us ever had a good feeling about McCaskey, even when Ditka got fired. Mike Royko wrote the article that the old man, Halas, when he supposedly was on his deathbed, said, not Michael, you know, like publicly, just the dude would rip on him. He always had that sort of like weird feeling, but he stepped up and he got his guy. And then he and Wannstedt, of course, showed up with their wives in matching trench coats at Soldier Field. And at, like, you know, that was Michael McCaskey's moment. Yes. But
it never got better for him. Actually, I guess. Maybe
for a couple years.
The one road playoff win. That we
celebrate whenever it comes up. But I don't recall too much about like who else was there, but other than the Bears did get the top guy.
Okay, I did. This was a search. I did remember who the number two candidate was, who the guy they would have gotten had the Giants been able to seal the deal for Dave Wannstedt.
Was it Dan Reeves?
He was also a 1963 Bear, because God forbid the Bears ever get away from that.
Oh, I know this. It came down to Wannstedt and Richie Pettibone. Not Jerry Pettibone, who was NIU's coach when I was a freshman. Okay, yeah.
Richie Pettibone, who at the time was the Redskins defensive coordinator. He would eventually become the Redskins coach.
And he looked
like he obviously played defensive tackle in the NFL, but he was a safety.
he was a fat old white guy. He actually held the Bears record for interceptions career until the aforementioned Gary Fensick, who's already been brought up for the second time, broke Richie Pettibone's franchise record. I don't know if Fensick still has it or not.
There were So in addition to Pettibone, there were three other candidates who got interviewed.
Let's see.
Two of which were internal, and another one who would go on to win national championships in college and a Super Bowl.
National champ. Okay, would that be Pete Carroll?
Pete Carroll, who at the
time
interview
with the Bears?
Was the defensive coordinator for the Jets.
That was just an educated guess. I have no recollection whatsoever.
The next year, he would coach the Jets.
Yes, and then the Patriots, right?
He did 1 year, got fired.
Yeah.
Went to the Niners, was defensive coordinator for 2 years, got the Pats job.
Yeah.
Got 2 years there, got fired, then went to USC, and now Seattle.
There was totally a time where Pete Carroll was just one of those nondescript, interchangeable guys in the 90s until he wasn't.
And then two holdovers from Ditka's staff.
Incredible. So, let's see. Vince Tobin, to give Vince an old cursory interview?
Nope. But both offensive coaches. Because, you know, the Bears, that offense was so – with Jim Harbaugh running things. It was so progressive. That's what you wanted.
The path to their door must have been – right. So let's see. Danny Abramowitz. Did they interview Danny Abramowitz? No. The interview was Ted Plumgon, Ed Hughes. I got nothing, Andy. I know. I got one good guess. Johnny Rowland.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure was because the players wanted them to interview Johnny. And Mike, okay, fine. Probably interviewed him for 5 minutes in an elevator someplace. Said I interviewed him. The other one was the offensive coordinator, and Ditka changed offensive coordinator so much to the end. It was
Greg Landry.
Greg Landry.
Was it the Silver Fox?
The Silver Fox. Right. Yes. As if when McCaskey finally gets his shot to hire a coach, he's going to hire one of the guys from Ditka's staff. There was no chance.
Right.
So, yeah, Wani was the shit. He was they was supposed to be the next great coach. The Cowboys were going to the Super Bowl again, second in a row. Both of their coordinators were super hot. Were super hot candidates. Everybody, for some reason, thought Wani of the two, you know, leader of men, hair lip, all that fun stuff. Mm-hmm. And the year before, I didn't know this, he was the runner-up for the Steelers job.
The Cowher got.
Yes. So Wani could have gone in the Hall of Fame last year.
To succeed Chuck. No, right. Right. Okay.
I don't doubt he was much worse of a coach. The fact that Bill Cowher's
no,
in the Hall of Fame.
He might, actually, that might have been would have made life better.
Pittsburgh
for
boy. He ended up, he had to settle for coaching at the University of Pittsburgh.
Like following another Western Pennsylvania boy, too, which I think that was, like, that was actually probably the one negative for McCaskey. God, he's like other than that, you know, unless he wanted the, there was a part of him that wanted to pander.
Part of the reason that Wani picked the Bears was Jimmy Johnson told him he would rather he coach the Bears than the Giants, so he wouldn't be in the division. Which, honestly, I think is a misjudgment by Jimmy.
Correct. In retrospect.
He should have known Wani was a dope. And he should have absolutely – maybe he was trying to do reverse psychology on him. He's like, you don't want to go to the Giants. I'm just going to have to kick your ass.
That's two easy W's every year. You know, and Jimmy must have had a blind spot because he threw Dave a lifeline after he eventually got canned from the Bears.
Yeah. Or maybe it was that he liked John Roper so much that he knew that eventually Jimmy – or that Dave would trade him to him.
Yes.
That must have been what it was. Guys, keep it down.
Yeah, and as we've discussed, the Wani era kind of, it wasn't really a low point. It was just a sort of a break from Ditka, and they were back in the playoffs 2 years, and then all of a sudden things were, you know, there was a foul, there was a stench in Denmark, whatever they call it. I think something was a foul, and then the bottom did. We did hit rock bottom by the end of the ones. Back to back, like what, 4-12 seasons. Should have been fired after the first one. Was it? Because by then, I feel like by then, McCaskey was like, "Well, I took my shot, and it didn't work. And I don't know what to do. And I don't know what to do." You'll remember, just to lead up to this, I remember like reporters talking about this afterward at the press conference in which it was announced that Wannstedt's services would no longer be retained. Michael McCaskey said, going forward, Mark Hatley will be in charge of firing up the coach. I only remember like reporters after the fact when they would like have to sort of perform an autopsy on all the dysfunction that was going to follow here, like pointing out that, Hatley was like visibly startled when McCaskey said that, as if McCaskey just sprung that on the room. And as we said, when Jerry Vannesi replaced Jim Finks and he was fired, they did not replace him as a general manager. They said they went through this Byzantine structure where they had a player personnel, which began as Bill Tobin and then Rod Graves and then Hatley. And that Hatley was in charge of scouting, and he had nothing to do with coaches. And like McCaskey was just so already checked out. His one moment didn't work out, and whether he was disappointed or just whatever, he just slaps this shit together. So when you do break it down, it's not a surprise to see all that dysfunction, because it was stenchy from the beginning. So even though normally when you fire a coach, like right now, we feel, even though we might have our reservations about Eberflus, you know, you get to be optimistic. It's a new start. You go forward. Even in this instance, in 1999, this is what to me makes it the all-time low point in Bears history, was that even after they relieved the pressure of getting her to Wannstedt, they just immediately made things worse for a bit. So, because it was, the thing was like off the rails from there, and it just showed how dysfunctional they were. Yeah. And Michael McCaskey.
Right. So 1999, they need a coach again, and they interviewed seven guys. And then they interviewed seven guys, two guys turned them down, and two guys they got permission to interview, and they didn't. So
they
offered
two
start
guys.
With the guys.
Oh, well, of course.
Let's start with the two guys who did not interview with them. Just after the search commenced, Marty Schottenheimer got fired by the Chiefs, and Mark Hatley joked, because he got asked about it by a reporter. He's like, would you be interested in Marty? And he said, yeah, probably. He should just send us his resume.
Yeah. And Hatley was an old Chiefs guy, I believe. So some connections there.
And Marty called him and said he appreciated it, but he didn't want to coach the next year. He wanted to take some time.
Which off. I'm fine with that, because Schottenheimer, you know, busted out often in the playoffs. He was getting pretty old. That wouldn't have been much of an inspiring hire, frankly.
The next guy they wanted to interview was a Super Bowl champion.
Eventual or already?
He'd already won his Super Bowl.
As a player or coach?
As a coach. And he went on to coach. He got hired by the Panthers too fast for the Bears to even interview him. It was George Seifert.
Wow, no recollection of that. I obviously know who George Seifert is. One of the very few coaches who have won more than one Super Bowl with different quarterbacks, but I don't remember. Maybe I do, but it's been mostly suppressed.
And then the two coaches that they got permission to interview but did not interview would also both win Super Bowls. You may have heard of them.
Yeah, I know one is Brian Billick.
One of them, yes, Brian Billick, who won a Super Bowl with the Ravens. The other one was Bill Belichick, which wouldn't have worked. I mean, it would have. No, actually, he was the perfect guy, but the Bears would have done what they needed to do. And it would have been to have hired Bill and have him just – so you don't have a GM. Bill just handles all that shit.
Yeah,
they wouldn't
but
do
at the
it
time,
because they had let Wani – Wani was the de facto GM.
That's something
and,
I forgot to
and
mention.
And was
yeah.
horrible at it.
Yes.
And there was no way they were going to let anybody have actual power.
Yeah, and that. Belichick was not in a position to demand that, frankly. I think at the time, Belichick was like a kind of a guy, really, like Pete Carroll. But I will say Billick was top of the line. He was the hot commodity. He had engineered that offense with Randall, an aging Randall Cunningham and rookie Randy Moss and Chris Carter for ridiculous yards until he, you know, arrogantly decided to keep pushing the ball at the end of the first half in the conference title game, but didn't hurt his chances to get a job. However, it speaks so much to how small market the Bears were thinking that, you know, that they never even got him in for an interview. He was the hot, like they were already setting their sights low.
Yeah, with Belichick, I also doubt he would have taken it because remember, was it? I don't know if it was 99 or 2000. My timeline's all goofed up.
We were talking about Al Groh?
Well, no, you know, Parcells quit with the Jets, and it was in Belichick's contract that if Parcells left, he succeeded him. And he didn't want the job to the point where he famously wrote his resignation letter on like a scrap piece of paper. And it said, I hereby resign as HC. Of NYJ. He couldn't even bother to write it all out. And he just handed it in and he was gone.
Yep. Okay, another ignominy for the Jets.
So the seven guys the Bears interviewed.
So we just named four. They didn't, but they were sort of out there. So they actually went through seven rounds.
Two didn't give them the chance. Two of them they did not even bother to try to sell.
All right.
I don't know why they even asked for permission if they weren't going to interview those guys.
Let's remember some crap.
We'll start at the bottom and work our way up to the two guys that both ended up being the coach.
There's a great story here.
Do you remember that Mark Hatley flew out to L.A. and interviewed former UCLA head coach Terry Donahue?
You think I would remember that, and I don't. Sorry, just to be honest, I should, because we have this, you know, have the same pronounced last name. No, it got Terry Donahue had to be like what 60 by then. So Jesus, all right.
Yeah, he was retired from UCLA.
I kind of do remember that now that you mention it. Yeah,
that was Hallie's. Hallie really wanted him. That was going to solve all the problems.
And oh, he said, "Well, dodged a bullet there, I guess."
They had a Packer offensive coordinator that they interviewed. This guy got interviewed by every team at least four times.
Is this the poster child for why we have the Rooney Rule?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, it's Sherman, right? Sherman Lewis, not Mike Sherman. Right, yeah.
Bears interviewed Sherman Lewis.
Okay, I kind of remember that. Yep.
They also hired Bills. They interviewed Bills offensive coordinator Joe Pendry.
Yep.
Who I think eventually would be a Bears running back coach.
He was,
I think. Hatley, he apparently was the guy Hatley really wanted to hire. And he his compliment to him in a when he was asked about him was he was really impressed that he could put together an offense that could make the playoffs with, quote, a quarterback nobody thinks can play, unquote, Doug Flutie. That was good. The other four guys on the list all ended up being head coaches in the NFL.
Okay.
Steelers defensive coordinator Jim Haslett interviewed for the Bear job.
Not a bad coach. We talked about Jim Finks bringing the Saints to the playoffs for the first time, and of course Jim Moore playoffs. Moore famously never won a playoff game. Haslett was finally the one to cross that line for the Saints. Not a bad coach for a little bit.
Crazy Chiefs defensive coordinator and future coach of the Chiefs, Gunther Cunningham.
Part of the reason he was probably so pissed that his first game was against the Bears and Cade McNown and Shane Matthews and really Gary Kraut were running circles around him. But yeah, I forgot he interviewed with the Bears. All right.
Then they interviewed Jaguars defensive coordinator Dick Geron.
Dick Geron!
And they were like, oof, that dude's even too boring for us. And then they interviewed the guy they loved. He'd already been a Bear. Perfect fit. Bring him home. Current defensive coordinator of the Cardinals, coaching for former Bears defensive coordinator Vince Tobin out in the desert.
Yep.
Slam dunk, Dave McGinnis.
Former Bear coach, not former Bear, but yeah, 100%.
Right, former Bear coach.
And, you know, even
linebacker coach.
Even at the time, at the moment, it really uninspiring, right? You see, mm-hmm. like Brian Billick go off to the Ravens.
Dave seems like a super nice guy to this day. Super nice guy.
His defenses play for him and all that jazz. But I remember, like convincing myself because I had enough meatball still in me. I was like, okay, you know, he's a young guy. You know, he's got some qualities. This could work. Trying to convince, but it's not like he was the guy. But we're resigned to him, and then all right, let's go. All right, let's go. But
so he was in town. He interviewed for the job. The interview went well. They all shook hands and slapped everybody on the back, and he went back to his hotel. And he said later he hopped in his rental car and was driving around, and he heard on the radio that he had been hired as the new coach of the Bears. There was one small problem.
Yeah,
nobody had told him, and they hadn't negotiated a deal.
Nobody had offered him the job. I read some oral history where he calls Hatley, and of course Hatley's like, fuck. Yeah. Like the ball guy. It wasn't even Hatley's almost a sympathetic character because he wasn't supposed to have been in that position anyway.
Right.
It's not his job. It's just organizational dropping the ball. It was real low point.
Right. So there were two issues there. Three issues. Number one, it's so fucking stupid that can actually happen. Issue number two is people, you think, all right, well, big deal. It got out too soon. I'm going to come in. I'll just negotiate my deal. Well, there was a feeling among Hatley and his agent that the Bears had done it on purpose because now he's kind of, it's like, hey, you're the coach. We can pay whatever the fuck we want because the world already knows you're the coach and you're not, there's no way you're going to turn us down now. You're not going to do it.
Unreal.
And then the third is, do you want to coach for a franchise that could fuck this up? And the answers to all those were no. He basically didn't. He never did negotiate again with the Bears, to the point where Mike called him hat in hand, and Dave said tough shit, and Ed McCaskey had to call and beg Dave to reconsider, and Dave wouldn't do it. And then the Cardinals were pissed because they didn't get the courtesy of the, hey, we're going to, we things went well, we're going to offer Dave the job. And Vince Tobin was pissed because he felt like the Bears of all teams could at least pick up the phone and tell him that they really were going to take his defensive coordinator.
Oh, wow. Just incredible failing from top to bottom. It didn't get any worse than that.
So Dave went back to being the defensive coordinator of the Cardinals. He ended up being the head coach of the Cardinals later.
He did. He did get a shot, but it's always a little bit of a stain.
Yeah, no great.
I remember being like, I don't know if my absolute frustration and agitation and just infuriation may have been an all-time high against that team. And I remember like just thinking, nobody should ever take this job. Let this franchise get humiliated day after day, and actually being mad, angry at this poor old Dick Geron, to where I was like calling him the R word even back then. Like, how, like, God, you're so desperate, you're gonna take the job. I mean, give me this, continue to humiliate you. You just wanted, it was a bloodletting. It was just so, it was, I can't even hardly describe
what R word were you calling Dick Geron?
Remedial. I think it was 1999, so I could even think that in my head.
I thought you were going to say he was a retread, but he wouldn't be. He would have been a pre-tread.
No, this was as it turned out, this was the beginning of a very nice run for Dick Geron, and I'm happy for him because, as discussed, Dick Geron.
Yeah, he got to be the coach. Decent man. He got to be the head coach of three different teams.
Right, and he was a decent. Like, if you line him up by personalness, like he's like the closest thing to a human being. He seemed like the most genuine person, a decent guy. Still a tough, you know, right, you know, football coach, but maybe a little bit righteous, and not even a horrible coach. And actually, as it turned out, they did lift off from this low point because at some point you can't get any lower. And so I'll always remember Dick Geron fondly for kind of getting them out of the muck and didn't really turn it around. And then we had the nice little Lovey era, which, like you kind of hinted at, was sort of a, you know, a mini Ditka era that, as sad as it is, was, you know, kind of got us through a while. And then they got rid of him, then, yeah. Right.
So Dick Geron ends up taking the job. And he had a hard time hiring coaches because – there was a feeling around the league, which is ironic because his eventual successor with the Bears is giving off the exact same vibes currently in Houston.
Oh,
which was, yeah, you're the coach, but you're not the guy they wanted. They had to settle for you. And as soon as you fail, they're going to do a new search. With Lovey in Houston right now, the feeling is they very clearly wanted to hire Josh McCown. They wanted to hire Josh McCown so bad. And they're going to shoehorn Josh onto Lovey's staff. And in a year or two, Josh McCown's going to be the coach.
Got it.
Makes
sense.
So that the poor Dick is going around trying to attract top, you know, coaches. And they're like, I don't think so. That's how you end up with a crazy person like Greg Blash coaching your defense and giving guys bullets.
You know, but Blotch was not a horrible coach.
No, he wasn't.
And they weren't bad.
Yeah, and they ironically gave us one of the most fun seasons in Bears history.
Absolutely.
The ridiculous 2001 season.
And they did. And they did pull us up. And, you know, there are only so many jobs. So I think at some point, like, while that's true that you might not want to be associated with the stink, most guys, if they get the opportunity, they're gonna roll the dice.
I don't think anybody around the league was like, I can't believe Geron took that job. Because there's only, were there 32 back then?
30. The Browns are coming in, so 31.
You know, nobody was like that, but I think the feeling was more of a,
right.
You better have success early, buddy, or you're gone. And he didn't the first year, and then he did the second year.
No, he didn't the first 2 years.
Not until the third year.
Yeah. Well,
although
he
may have had some job security in that the Bears were deathly afraid to have a search again.
Well, and that's
why. We're just going to fuck it up.
Well, and that's why, in the wake of all this, Michael got bumped to. This was not when they hired George, but they did do a reorganization. So that was the real. It was a good consequence that came out of this, as embarrassing as it was.
He was the president and chairman of the board. And after this, he was only the chairman of the board, which is what George's position is. And Sweaty Teddy got to be president.
So it was a big day. It was a big day for Teddy.
Yes.
But then also, as fans, we are at least happy because they did at least realize how stupid it was to go at that point, 15 years without a general manager. Right. So, but then, of course, now they're in this staggered era where they have a head coach, and then they bring in Jerry Angelo, who, you know, wants to bring in Nick Saban or whatever, and then of course Duran, you know, a lame duck. That's when they go 13-3. So they stretch.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale. Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Stretches it out. It just sort of, it stretches out the dysfunction, but such as it is.
So that's a good segue. So now Dick lasts until through the 2003 season, and then it's time to do another search, and Jerry Angelo is now your general manager. You have a real general manager.
Yeah, let's get a line.
What you think of Jerry Angelo? He assembled a Super Bowl team.
I will defend Jerry Angelo. I am actually a bit of a Jerry Angelo fan with the relatively low bars, but yeah.
And he apparently he's still well regarded enough within the Bears front office that he got asked about to offer his opinion on coaching and general manager candidates in the last search. The one that just wrapped up.
Better than, you know, Ernie Accorsi.
So he says, all right, I'm going to hire a coach. And he takes as big a swing as he can. He flies down to Baton Rouge, and he talks to Nick Saban, who everyone assumes is just waiting to get back into the NFL. He just won a national championship at LSU.
And back in the NFL? Oh, yeah, right. He coached Belichick and the Browns. You reminded me of that. Sorry.
Nick had already been in and out of Miami, hadn't he?
He went from LSU to Miami.
You're right. He went from LSU to Miami.
That was the insult.
So Jerry was right. Jerry knew that Nick was ready to go to the NFL.
The stars were lined up, man.
And the biggest problem Jerry had was that the Bears would not let him offer enough money.
Is that all it was?
Yes. He was only allowed to offer Nick $3.5 million a year. And the year before, the head ball coach, Steve Spurrier, had gotten $5 million to go to Washington. And Nick said, fuck off.
Before we get too angry, I'm only going to say that Lovey did have moderate success and that Nick Saban, of course, did come back in the NFL and not enjoy success. However, if you want to really indulge in an alternate fantasy, that can be a frustrating thing to ponder.
Well, here's the thing. Nick Saban was not the only other person they offered the job to.
Before Lovey, you mean?
Yes. So after the first four coaches that they interviewed were all college coaches, current college coaches. After Saban turned down the Bears, Jerry went, in order, to Maryland, where he interviewed Ralph Friedgen.
Don't remember. Was it J in his name?
No, G. Friedgen. With G-E-N.
Got it.
He didn't offer Ralph the job, but he interviewed Ralph. He then stopped off in lovely Iowa City, where he interviewed Kirk Ferentz.
Jesus. So
he also did not offer Kirk the job. But then he went to Berkeley, California, and he interviewed the electric Jeff Tedford, who would have, what, just been? Let's see. Would Aaron Rodgers have been on campus at the time?
Aaron Rodgers was a rookie in 2005, so 4-3-2-1. No. Wait. Yeah, 2004. Oh, absolutely. He was in the thick of it.
They offered the job to Jeff. Well, they didn't actually offer him the job. They interviewed him. If Jerry liked what he heard, he called Jeff back, said, I want you to come to Hallis Hall. Mm-hmm. We're going to give you a second interview. Basically let Jeff's agent know we're going to offer Jeff the job, and Jeff didn't want to come to the Bears. He turned down the second interview.
This is after the Saban rejection, yes. Right? That was his first guy. Okay.
The ironic thing is, if you want to think about it, if Tedford takes the job, the Bears probably end up with Aaron Rodgers.
No, because they just had drafted Rex Grossman.
I don't think Jeff would have let Rex Grossman stand in the way.
I think
didn't they draft Rex? They already
2003.
Had, they drafted 2003 Rex
in
Geron's
last season. Yeah, and he was not.
I have a feeling they could have figured out a way to.
Yes. Well, I do want to indulge in the alternate fantasy.
But also,
moment,
Jeff Tedford never amounted to shit. Anyway.
Well, that's why I said that could have been like the move that would have benefited both of them. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
like maybe that was Jeff Tedford's path. And he turned them down, so good. Fuck you, Jeff Tedford. Yep. I'm glad you're like barely an athlete.
Oh, he knew the great Kyle Buller was going to be rolling onto campus any day
Jesus
now.
Jesus Christ,
he coached Rodgers and then him, and woo. Okay, so after the Tedford thing, Jerry's like, all right, fuck it. I am done talking to college coaches. Screw that. We're going to get us a real live NFL coach. And he apparently gave a courtesy interview to the great Greg Blash, who was on his way to interview for the Steelers job and basically demanded he get interviewed for the Bears job first. And
at
Jerry did. Yeah, probably. And Jerry did, even though he had no intention of hiring Greg Blash.
Okay.
Mike Nolan, who was the defensive coordinator of the Ravens, his interview got rescheduled twice because Jerry was flying around interviewing college coaches, and Nolan, after the second phone call, said, "You know what? Don't. That's okay."
Well, yeah, you take the hint after two. You're not getting hired.
Don't worry about it. Yeah, so then we get down to the two guys who actually we knew, you know, the finalists, and they called these two the finalists, and everybody laughed because he already offered the job to two guys. The next two guys are not the finalists.
He's the third and fourth finalists,
and they were Steelers offensive line coach Russ Grimm.
He got that far to being a finalist?
People thought he was going to get the job.
Oh, my God.
He to the point where after his interview, he did the press conference, the famous press conference where he wore the sweater, and he called the McCaskies the McClatchies or whatever he called them.
He was right out of Central Casting for, like, the stereotypical George Wentz SNL Superfans beer sketch.
And I was reading the story about it, and Lovie famously did it during his hiring press conference. But in this one, Grimm talked about how the first thing they were going to do, they were start beating the Packers.
So stupid.
He goes, we're going to start beating the Packers, we're going to start winning Central Division Championships. That's what we're going to do.
Wow. The more things change, right? It wasn't that Eberflus's one takeaway from his thing? We're going to take the North and not give it back.
Yep. That was Poles that said that.
I'm sorry, it was Poles. You're right. I don't recall. I knew that Grimm was in there. I already made the reference to the Russ Grimm sweater because he showed up wearing this woolly, sort of like he just came from a Christmas party. It's just funny, Andy, as we go through this, to think that the two most successful coaches in our lifetime are really, it was lucky we even got him. Like, they almost could have gotten somebody so much worse.
Right. The lucky thing for the Bears turned out to be that Lovie was unexpectedly available because his Rams defense got obliterated in a playoff loss to the, I think it was the Panthers, right?
In 02, 03, you're right. That was the double overtime game.
Right.
So it couldn't have been obliterated unless the offense kept up, as you probably
know. Well, no, they gave up, his defense gave up a shitload of yards.
High scoring game, yeah.
And suddenly, Lovie, you can hire Lovie now. You don't have to wait till the Super Bowl because they're out of the playoffs.
So Lovie was a defensive coordinator in 99 for Tampa, or maybe D-backs coach, that somehow held the Rams for the first time all year to a minimal amount of points until Ricky Prohl, who always shows up, caught the winning touchdown. But then he switched to the Rams and was their DC when they almost won their second Super Bowl till Tom Brady won his first. So I forgot about that 03 game. Could have been a mark against them.
So Lovie came in and got to interview a second time in person. And I'm sure he talked about how we're going to beat Green Bay. Yeah. And the Bears were smitten and had their coach.
Yeah, it checked a lot of boxes. And of course, we were feeling a little low because, you know, Nick Saban was the guy, and it's like, oh, fuck. It's like our fifth choice. And then, of course, careful what you wished for, right? We want, you know, Wannstedt was the top guy, and he busted. Ditka was hired at the end result of this incredibly dysfunctional process engineered by a nonagenarian. And, you know, Lovie was the seventh choice, and they were the two best coaches. So it's funny. But at the time, it was not so funny because we were very unsure. But, it, you know, at least in that case, it worked out.
So in Lovie's case, the writing was on the wall after the 2011 season, right? The Bears fire Jerry Angelo, and they don't fire Lovey, and Lovey even gets to interview, he's on the search committee for the general manager. Uh-huh. And they hire Phil Emery, and Phil tells, let's see who would have been at the time, that we were up to George, and now we're to George.
Yeah, George, I think, is in charge now, right.
And at he some tells point them he wants to fire Lovey. And they say, you can't.
Yeah, once again, which staggering the process.
Everybody knew that that just meant that Lovey's got one more year, and no matter what happens, mm-hmm. he's out. And the Bears go 10-6, but they were 7-1 at one point. But they went 10-6, barely missed the playoffs, and that gave Phil the opening he needed, and he fired Lovey.
Yeah.
And then he embarked on, we might want to take a break. Because we are about the 2013
Let's
search.
Let's all go to the lobby.
There were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 candidates. It took 13 candidates to come up with Mark Trestman.
Phil Emery just proving to HR that I'm working.
Yes. Wow. There were, let's start with the two that didn't interview.
I love how you've categorized them. I genuinely appreciate that because there are these different levels here.
Oh, the best thing about this is there were, let's see, they had a type here. There was one exception. Everybody was either an offensive coordinator or a special teams coordinator. They interviewed 4 special teams coordinators.
Okay.
The one defensive player was rumored that the Bears were interested. And my assumption is that Dan Pompey was the one who floated the rumor. Linebacker coach of the Minnesota Vikings, Samurai Mike Singletary.
Oh, my God.
The Bears did not interview Mike Singletary.
Of course, Pompey just recently reissued that in spite of the fact that he had to be self-aware enough to know how ridiculous that was.
The other candidate who was rumored but never interviewed was the immortal Mike Pryfer, special teams coordinator of the Vikings.
Didn't get an interview.
Not good. So the guys they did interview. Offensive coordinator from the Texans, Rick Dennison. The only reason I remembered who Rick Dennison was when I was writing the article about Brian Daboll. Sean McDermott in Buffalo showed what you're really supposed to do when a quarterback falls in your lap. Rick Dennison was his offensive coordinator his first season in Buffalo. The next year, they drafted Josh Allen, and after the draft, they fired Rick Dennison. And they hired Brian Daboll and told Rick, sorry, it's not you did a bad job, but everything's about this quarterback now. And we need to find somebody who's going to develop this quarterback, which is exactly what the Bears should have done last year when Justin Fields fell in their lap. And they said, all right, now fuck off.
Right.
But they didn't do it. Another guy was perpetual candidate. He's been an interim a couple of times. Otherwise, he'd be the white Sherm Lewis. Seahawks offensive coordinator, Daryl Bevel.
Daryl Bevel, right. That's right, because he coached against the Bears. I only remember that because he coached against the Bears last year, and we remembered some crap about, right? Like, he was thrust into the head coaching job last year.
He was interim in Detroit. I believe he may have also been an interim somewhere else, maybe Jacksonville? They like to fire coaches in season.
Never got his own
real gig. He took over for Urban.
Oh, Jesus. Wow. He's going to pass Dick Geron in the interim coach. Well, actually, no, Dick Geron's – that's not fair. Dick Geron, I think, has only been an interim coach once.
Yeah, only once. Also in Detroit, because every coach has been an interim coach in Detroit once.
Can we just stop for a minute? I know it's not even funny anymore. I was talking about it with my brother this week. It's like they're even worse than the Cubs from 08. It's like it's not even funny anymore. It's like they're going to win it now because if Matthew Stafford already has twice as many playoff wins as a non-Lion than the Lions have in the last 70 years. It's just you can't keep piling on. I don't even care anymore. It's like it's funny, but it's not even funny anymore. So anyway.
This is great. Only the Bears. They interviewed in order. They interviewed one of their former special teams coordinators, Keith Armstrong.
Dave Tobe? Oh, not Dave Tobe. Okay, well, he was probably current. Yeah.
Right. Former special teams coordinator Keith Armstrong, who was the special teams coordinator of the Falcons. Then they interviewed future Bears special teams coordinator Joe DeCamillis.
I don't remember him as all right.
If you remember Joe was not his special teams with the Bears were not good, but he's probably most famous for, do you remember when the practice bubble collapsed in Dallas and it landed on Joe and almost paralyzed him?
Oh, I do.
So there's something he remembered for. And then they interviewed, at the time, current Bears special teams coordinator, Dave Tope. And Dave told Mark Hatley, or not Mark Hatley, Jerry Angelo, right? We're at Jerry Angelo? Yeah.
He told Jerry Angelo. We're talking 2013, right? Or 12, 13, right? Yeah, okay.
That, not Jerry Angelo.
Phil Emery.
That's right. This makes more sense because Phil had just, one of Phil's first things he did was he gave Jay a contract extension.
Yes, after the 2011 season.
The Bears had to eat a shitload of that money when Jay left.
I was in favor of the deal at the time, but it absolutely was not the right
Dave
deal.
Dave told, he probably didn't have the leverage to do this, but he did it anyway. He told Phil, I'll coach the team, but you got to trade Jay.
Wow.
And they said, nope, not going to do that.
So, yeah, another guy with integrity like Dave McGinnis could have taken the job.
Well, and he had a
job.
Pretty good read, I think, of the team, which was most of the team were, doesn't like
actually,
Jay.
They were reaching the end of a real talent thing because I think it's clear that by the end of the Trestman era, there was nothing.
Well, yeah,
so.
The defense was falling apart.
They were getting old.
Their offensive line was falling apart.
Yeah.
What Phil did was he brought in, he gave Jay actual weapons. Brandon Marshall, Martellus Bennett.
Drafted
Alshon. But they didn't fix any of the other stuff. And so Jay just kept getting hit in the head a lot. They gained a lot of yards the first year. And by the second year, Trestman's only other year, it was over.
That's true.
Okay, so they got through all the special teams coaches. And then they interviewed.
No more. So far, we haven't had Steve Kazor's name invoked in tonight's podcast. Okay. I brought up Danny Abramowicz incorrectly, and then Keith Armstrong and Dave Tom. So
then they went on a slew of offensive coordinators. They interviewed Tom Clements from the Packers, former Notre Dame quarterback.
Notre Damer. Yeah, he went to CFL. Yeah.
Also, a guy that Aaron Rodgers was recommending to anyone that would hear would be a good head coach. He never had to be a head coach.
Yeah, it shows you. Rodgers did his research and thought that Tom Clemens would be a great coach, and obviously was proven wrong because nobody knows who the fuck Tom Clemens is right now.
Then they interviewed Saints offensive coordinator Pete Carmichael. Pete Carmichael suffered from the thing that a lot of the Andy Reid offensive coordinators do. Sean Payton's the offensive coordinator of the Saints. It was at the time. Now he's gone. And so everybody's like, oh, that's great, but you don't really coordinate that often.
You're not actually calling. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
So then they interviewed Buccaneers offensive coordinator Mike Sullivan. No idea who that was.
Just the guy you go drinking with, it sounds like.
Then they interviewed Broncos offensive coordinator Mike McCoy.
I remember.
Who would eventually be the head coach in San Diego.
Okay.
And it wouldn't really work out.
Nope. Sorry, so far, unlike the Belichick, Pete Carroll references of the past or Brian
this
Billy,
is a big not, list of bad.
Nothing. It's like
Phil Emery's list was terrible. He had one good coach on it. We're about to get to it.
He's doing busy work because he's convinced HR is watching him, and he has to. Yeah.
Then they interview the reigning NFL Coach of the Year.
Wait, I'm sorry. The reigning NFL Coach of the Year.
The reigning NFL Coach of the Year.
And so in 2012, that's the year that Jim Harbaugh took the Niners to the Super Bowl. Wouldn't Jim Harbaugh?
This is the year that a future Bears defensive coordinator got leukemia. And his offensive coordinator took over and won Coach of the Year.
This is Bruce Arians. Yeah, this is the tragic departure.
And Bruce went in and told Phil, I want to coach Jay Cutler. We're gonna turn this offense around, and it's because Jay can sling it, and I want to coach him.
Already, sunk his future.
And that
into.
No, that should have been music to Phil's ears.
That's what I'm saying.
Phil had chained himself to.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Right.
And that should have been all he needed to hear. He should have thrown him a contract after he said that.
Yeah. Exactly.
Bruce leaves the interview convinced that he has the job. He's 100% sure. But then. The final guy who gets interviewed, the reigning Grey Cup champion, Montreal Alouettes head coach, Mark Trestman, who had been an offensive coordinator, quarterback, famous quarterback coach of the 49ers with Steve Young. He'd been an offensive coordinator with the Raiders, and the 49ers. Yeah. And anybody who'd ever played for him was like, that is one weird dude.
And we got
and Phil, also a very strange person.
Yeah.
The two of them get in a room together, and they fall madly in love with each other.
Couple of Moonies.
And yeah. George likes Mark because George doesn't like... Yeah, George is a weirdo, and he's afraid of football guys. He's a football... He's supposedly the chairman of a team, but he's... They scare him. And here was this egghead with a horrible comb-over who I'm sure charmed the shit out of George, and Bruce didn't stand a chance.
You nailed it, and it's so tragic in retrospect. I will say, it wasn't as hard to convince me in the Trestman hire as it was for... well, certainly, the Geron hire, but he did. You alluded to his relationship with Steve Young. It was a weird thing in 2013 when Trestman had gotten to that point, because he was a guy that, like 12 years earlier, he was one of these perennial annual top head coaching candidates. He was the next big thing. He was the, you know, when you talk about the offensive coordinators that get elevated and move on and fail or succeed, and somehow it's like he didn't get a job and he disappeared. But he was a guy that we remember, even if you were a casual fan, or you had to be somewhat of a geek, but you'd hear his name, and he worked with these quarterbacks, and he was on these winning sidelines, and then he all of a sudden, like, you would have forgotten about him had he not all of a sudden get recirculated in this coaching search. Well, it turns out he's been in Canada, and he's had five Grey Cups or three Grey Cups. And so I think, even honestly, in retrospect, it's not revisionist to say that I think it didn't feel laughable at the time. Laughable in retrospect, 100%. At the time, though, it was like, okay, well, maybe he wasn't ready 10 years ago. Maybe it was a blessing that he didn't get hired as the next young hot thing. Maybe he had maturity issues and had to go to Canada and figure it out and be a leader or whatever. I remember convincing myself, almost like with McCaskey and Wanstedt, that they beat the field. They got the guy they wanted. And I think even on sports radio and the local media and the general consensus, like, wasn't like the Dick Geron, like, well, we got this guy. It was like, okay, that was the feeling at the time, but it did not take and Trestman had moderate success early on in his first year. The offense was kind of amazing, whether it was, you know, Cutler or McCown, but then once, like with Wanstedt, once it went sideways, it never came back, and then all of his flaws were exposed. And then it's a lot easier to look back and go, and you see, you know, after you see Bruce Arians take off, and it's obvious in retrospect, man, what a tragic flip it was. But it wasn't like a total, like, weird, eccentric move at the time. It did make a certain level of sense, but that doesn't mean shit. We're not the guys that are tasked with making these decisions. So
he had such a weird, like, resume. He had like a degree in finance. He didn't start off as a coach. He was a volunteer assistant at the University of Miami. Then he got to be the quarterback coach, and that was under Schnellenberger. He was Bernie Kosar's quarterback coach. So that That got him noticed in the NFL. He started off as a running back coach with the Vikings, and that's not that unusual. You basically take the first job you can get in the NFL, and then
give the ball to Darren Nelson. Yeah.
Then he was the quarterback coach of the Bucks, and I believe that was Steve Young's rookie year.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Which is where he made the connection with Steve.
Okay.
Then he was the offensive coordinator for the Browns for 2 years.
Back to Kosar.
Then the quarterback coach of the Vikings. Then for 2 years, offensive coordinator and quarterback coach of 95-96 under Seifert with Steve Young in San Francisco.
Okay. That was a sweet spot.
97, he's quarterback coach in Detroit. 98 to 2000, offensive coordinator for the Cardinals. Dave McGinnis.
It was. No, it's Vince Tobin. It's Vince Tobin, 98. Okay. Yep.
Then three years as offensive coordinator of the Raiders.
He did get a productive season out of Jake Plummer, which is our friend Kyle Morris would say would otherwise be physically impossible. So that's a feather in his cap.
Then he got to be, 3 years with the Raiders, then a year with the Dolphins. So
3 years the Raiders, not as OC, or was it? Because that would have been included a Super Bowl team. Just FYI.
He was the OC, but I believe he Let's see.
Maybe did he have maybe a private conversation with Barrett Robbins that just fucking freaked Barrett Robbins out, and that's why they.
So that was the Bill Callahan Raiders. Yeah.
Well, because you said 98-99 right before that, and I thought you said 3 years. Well,
the Raiders, it was 01-03.
Yeah, the OC. All right, so he's on the sideline. So he's had success. He's success adjacent as an OC and quarterbacks coach at this point.
Yeah, he was the Raiders offensive coordinator when Rich Gannon was MVP.
So a young Steve Young and old Rich Gannon, you know, all right.
Then he was the assistant head coach of the Dolphins for a year. And then he couldn't find a job in the NFL, and he went to NC State and was the offensive coordinator. And this is impressive. He was there when they won the Meineke Car Care Bowl. So there you go.
Hey, well, that's probably what turned it around for him. It's just weird. It's so obvious. He was a guy that if other fan bases are doing these types of stupid episodes that we're doing, his name's coming up a lot. He must have been a candidate for like 12 teams in that 10-year period.
Yeah.
And he never got a job. It's kind of a weird thing because he really was legitimately considered a top guy.
When the Bears hired him in 2013, he hadn't been an offensive coordinator in the NFL in a decade, and he hadn't been in the NFL in 9 years.
That's what really makes it sort
of
borderline.
2 years at NC State and then 5 seasons as the head coach of the Montreal Alouettes, where he did win 2 Grey Cups.
Just 2.
He then won one after the Bears with the Toronto Argonauts.
Yeah, well, that's all right.
So he gets to the Bears, and after 2 years, he gets canned, and he goes to become the offensive coordinator of the Ravens, gets fired during his second season.
Okay.
And then he went off to Toronto, and then his last job, he was the head coach, general manager of the XFL's, it was the XFL? Yeah, the XFL's Tampa Bay Vipers, because nobody says Vipers Mark Trestman.
grow the football.
And he always starts the first practice every year. He holds up a football and says, "This is a football."
You know, it's cool when our coaches pretend to be pseudo intellectuals and win, like Phil Jackson. But when they don't, I ain't got time for it.
So after 2 years as the head coach, Emery's fired, Trestman's fired.
Yeah, which is incredible. Emery was for 2 years. His one coaching hire was so fucking awful that he was denied.
And so here are the Bears without a general manager. They don't have anybody to hire a head coach. So they go out and they get the brightest mind they can find. Ernie Accorsi. Ernie irons his toupee, slaps it on his head, shows up, and he's going to run the coaching search. And...
yeah, on his drive from Sycamore, apparently. George McCaskey lives in Sycamore. Did you know this? On his drive from Sycamore to Lake Forest. I was on a Twitter conference. Somebody figured out that he lives in Sycamore. That somewhere between Sycamore and Lake Forest that he passed some sort of a assisted living facility and found Ernie Accorsi.
Yep.
And then that inspired him to go about his day.
So Ernie comes in, and he's going to help pick the general manager and the coach. And so just like they did this year, they start with 2 searches simultaneously.
Right. Right.
And in phase 1, while they're interviewing general manager candidates, they would eventually hire Ryan Pace to be their general manager. They reached out to the Ravens and asked for permission to interview their offensive coordinator, Gary Kubiak.
To be their GM?
To be the head coach.
Head coach, right. After head coach is installed. All right.
And he said he had no plans to be a head coach. So he turned it down, which becomes interesting in a minute. They talked to Doug Marrone, who had been the head coach of the Bills and had opted out of his contract in a huff and was on the street needing a job. He would end up in Jacksonville.
Right.
And they interviewed the Broncos offensive coordinator Adam Gase. And Adam would eventually end up being the Bears offensive coordinator.
Eventually. So he wasn't as of, what were we talking about now? 2014, right? So okay.
They also interviewed Lions defensive coordinator Terrell Austin. So that was the first phase of interviews. Then Mike Shanahan got fired by the Redskins. And Shanahan started telling people that he was interested in the Bears job because he wanted another shot at coaching Jay. Because he had been the coach when Jay got drafted by Denver, and then Josh McDaniels came in, and the That's Broncos right. immediately traded Jay.
I vaguely remember.
And Shanny wanted the job, and the interesting thing is, if they had hired Shanny, they would have gotten Kyle Shanahan as the offensive coordinator. The Bears were not interested. They did
why
not.
Are you doing this to me?
They did not interview Mike Shanahan.
It could have been the third example of the Bears succeeding in spite of themselves. They just accidentally hired Mike Shanahan.
So then the Bears hire Ryan Pace as the general manager. And they tell him, hey, congratulations. By the way, Todd Bowles is here. Why don't you go interview him? They did the same thing to Ryan Poles when they said, oh, by the way, Jim Caldwell's been standing in the lobby for an hour and a half. Would you please go down and interview him?
Yeah. So he's holding a bus transfer that expires in 35 minutes. If you wouldn't mind, can you get down there? Yeah.
Bowles was the defensive coordinator for the Cardinals and was a hot commodity as a head coaching candidate.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So they interviewed him.
And again, this is back. We're 2015, right?
So, 2015.
Yeah.
Yes. Bowles would get interviewed again a couple of weeks ago. Uh-huh. So with the next guy, Pace interviewed Dan Quinn, who was the defensive coordinator of the Seahawks. And by all accounts, that was the guy he wanted to hire. He was going to hire Dan Quinn.
That's right.
And then the Broncos fired John Fox, who had taken them to the Super Bowl 2 years before. They had lost in spectacular fashion in the playoffs, I think on the Jacoby Jones ridiculous catch down the sidelines by the Ravens. I believe that was the loss.
Yeah, over
fired
the
John
Harbaugh
Fox.
Bowl.
Yes.
Oh, wait, no, right, after that, right. Well, Fox gets blown out in the Super Bowl, and then, you're right.
Then the next year, they get knocked out of the playoffs early. Yeah. John Elway says, fuck this. So he fires John Fox unexpectedly.
Yep.
Hires Gary Kubiak, the guy who turned the Bears on. Said, I don't want to be a head coach. He went to be a head coach. He was John Elway's former roommate with the Broncos.
Backup quarterback, yeah.
And Ernie Accorsi and John Fox, former New York Giants.
There's a connection.
Pals.
Yeah.
Ernie tells George, oh, you got to hire John Fox. You got this general manager. You need a steady hand at the wheel. You can't go hire Dan Quinn and have two young guys trying to figure it out. You got to hire Foxy.
For the record, I want one thing to be clear here. I agree that hiring John Fox was not necessarily Ryan Pace's decision. And I'm going to be nuanced here. I feel that he actually was free to make his own decision. And not even a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, but like you could do it even though he was being encouraged to hire Fox. And he hired Fox and passed on Quinn because he felt, well, if this one doesn't work out, then I buy myself that time, as opposed to just fucking going for it and being like, hey, I've got all the enthusiasm of a new job. I'm bringing in my people and rolling the dice with your first hire. So, no, it wasn't that he was – so much, I wanted to draw a distinction because you and Pusey Terry kind of broke it down. And I'm not trying to correct you. I'm just saying, like, I do think effectively he was kind of forced to fire Fox, but I do also think he had the freedom to make his own decision. And he did it by his own volition, because in his own calculation that like it was understood that it wasn't his hire. So if and when it doesn't work out, now he can start the clock. And by doing so, he passed on Quinn.
It's funny because a lot of the reasons that the Bears hired Fox ended up working out the way they suspected them. The problem was they didn't anticipate the facts that Fox basically had stopped giving a shit.
Right. They weren't really.
Because they said, okay, what you're going to do is you're going to bring in a guy who's been to two Super Bowls. He's an established coach. This team is terrible. And it was. The team was awful. In fact, and then they said, and he's going to bring good coaches. And he did. He brought Vic Fangio to be his defensive coordinator.
That's right.
Because Harbaugh had run off and left poor Vic alone with the Niners.
Right.
And he hired Adam Gase. He brought Adam, and Adam was a respected offensive coordinator who actually did a nice job with Jay the first year.
Did in fact produce, I believe, Jay Cutler's finest offensive season as a Bear, if I'm not mistaken.
So that makes a lot of sense for a rookie GM. This head coach is going to give you stability. He's going to bring in good coaches. And by the way, he's older. You're going to be here for 10 years at least. You're going to get to hire your coach next time.
You can totally map out this 8-year succession plan
And so a lot of that worked. The problem was Fox didn't seem to give a shit anymore, which is a problem.
He was just cashing the
check. And then Fangio famously has said, and it always cracks me up, he goes, when I got to the Bears in 2015, he goes, the talent level wasn't that of an expansion team. We didn't have that many good players.
Right.
And I think that may have been part of what made Fox kind of check out was the whole, holy shit, this team is bad.
Oh, way to do your due diligence, though, John. You could have figured that out before you.
No, he got a 4-year contract, and he's still spending the money. He didn't.
Well, I know, but.
So, and we Pusser and I talked a lot the last few weeks about how Ryan Pace fucked up. And one of the ways he fucked up was when he decided in 2017
to draft Mitch.
That he had 2017. He had to draft Mitch.
2017, yep.
I got drafted. This is the guy. Got to get Mitch.
Yep.
When you realize you can't tell your head coach who you want to pick,
that's a red flag.
You need to fire your head coach. And then you could have then brought in another head coach who may have said, you know what? Mitch, not that good.
And
of the other quarterbacks? Because like Pace was afraid to tell Fox they were going to draft a quarterback.
He had no balls. Well, what security are you risking, by going down that path? You've already, sort of reserved that card in your pocket by hiring Fox, knowing that you're going to get another hire. So now is the fucking time to strike.
Didn't work out, and it didn't work out a year earlier than you thought. You just go ahead and do it. He didn't do it, and that's part of why he's on the street.
He sucks, right now. Right, and he doesn't deserve to be. It's not like he's been wronged. It's like, he might be a decent guy, a decent professional in some respects. I don't know, player personnel. I don't want to even go down that path, but the fact is he didn't. So,
Todd Bowles goes and takes a job with the Jets. Didn't really work out.
Head coach,
Then he went to be the defensive coordinator with the Bucks, and he won a Super Bowl. Dan Quinn became the head coach of the Falcons, went to the Super Bowl.
Kind of famously.
The biggest lead in Super Bowl history.
Should have won, but kind of blew it,
Gary Kubiak won the Super Bowl with Denver.
Wow. So, of all of these are – the Bears didn't have the talent where it would have mattered, but it is funny that –
And then I was telling you before we started recording, I remember scarcely little about the next search, the Matt Nagy search. I didn't – I don't know if it was because the Cubs had won the World Series and it's all I was going to focus on forever was that. Yeah. And for the next 5 years, I could give a shit about the Bears. The Cubs won the World Series.
Could be. I'm going to go with PTSD, but because I don't either. I just know Nagy, it was it. And
so they went and the first person they interviewed was a future NFL head coach. They interviewed their own defensive coordinator, Vic Fangio. And they were pretty sure when they didn't hire him, they were pretty sure he was going to leave. And he didn't. He stuck around. Coached with Nagy, which is the only reason Nagy had a good first season. Because the defense drugged that team to the playoffs.
They really did.
And then fucked it up. They couldn't stop Nick Foles twice.
Well, when it counted, right. And Golden Tate, who would always haunt the Bears. But
they went up to the Twin Cities, and they interviewed both coordinators. They interviewed Vikings defensive coordinator George Edwards, who the Vikings interviewed for hours before they settled on the guy they're hiring, the Kevin O'Connell, O'Connor, the guy from the Rams, this time. Both and the electric Pat Shurmur.
Oh, Pat Shurmur.
They went on to be the head coach of the Giants for a week and a half.
I was good. Right. Yeah.
They also interviewed one of their future coaches. At the time, Eagles quarterback coach John D. Filippo, who everybody was pretty sure that was the guy they were going to hire. Like, it was Coach Flip. He yeah. ended up going to the – when Shermer got the job with the Giants, DeFilippo got the offensive coordinator job in Minnesota, which everyone assumed was a head coach in waiting position for him. He was going to go there, run an offense, going to be great. He made it half the season. Mike Zimmer fired him and made Kevin Stefanski the offensive coordinator, and Stefanski is now the head coach of the Browns.
Good move by Zimmer.
And DeFilippo ended up being a consultant for a year, and then the Bears hired him, and he was the quarterback right. coach, and then he got fired with Nagy and the rest of the guys. Things haven't worked out for Flip.
No.
Then here's an interesting connection. They interviewed Patriots offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels.
On the record? I don't remember that.
McDaniels didn't take the Bears job because he took, he didn't get offered to him, but he took the Colts job.
Oh, yeah.
And with the Colts, he,
that was concurrent.
He told Chris Ballard, hey, here are the coaches I want, one of which is this guy I want to hire as a defensive coordinator. I want
talk Matt, about a butterfly flapping its
I
wings.
I want Matt Eberflus. And the Colts hired Eberflus.
Yeah.
And then McDaniel said, you know what? I'm not coming. Sorry.
Because he's a weirdo, right?
And the Colts were stuck with Matt Eberflus. And he ended up doing a great job for them.
To the point his where, credit, Eberflus made the most out of a very uncertain situation. Yes. I would
he
think
won over Frank Reich, went away right away. Frank told him, you run that. You run the defense. I'm going to worry about the offense. And
that's a good sign. I'll hang my hand on anything, even that.
But then they set up an interview the day after a Chiefs-Titans playoff game in Kansas City.
Yep.
The Chiefs shit all over themselves in the second half of a game, mostly because their offensive coordinator refused to call any runs.
Yeah.
They lost.
Who was their offensive coordinator anyway, Andy?
It was a guy named Matt Nagy or who gives a fuck.
We don't have his full name or middle name like Lee Arthur Smith or Randall it's Kirk
Matthew
Myers.
Matthew Xavier Aloysius Nagy, I'm sure. And he so won over Ryan Pace that Ryan had him hop on the plane. He didn't make him go. Didn't make him fly coach to O'Hare and have George pick him up. They hopped on the Bear Force One, and they flew right back to. And he was introduced as the head coach of the Bears, and everything worked out just great.
We all lived happily ever after and all forgot about 1985. The future was just nothing but a bright white light of euphoria.
So it's funny. If you go back and look at all the coaching searches, you could pretty much every year you're like, oh, it's too bad they didn't hire this guy. It's too bad they didn't hire that guy. Pace's coaching search, the second one, the one where they hired Nagy, there's nobody.
A lot of them are, I feel like.
I mean, at least in the, even, yeah, like the both of his searches. I mean, he didn't interview Mike Shanahan, and Shanahan was in his 60s by then.
But you bring up a point about the transition to Kyle.
Well, and you get the idea, okay, if the idea is you need to hire the veteran coach because you have the rookie general manager,
right.
Shouldn't you hire Mike Shanahan instead of John Fox?
Right.
Hire the guy who wants to coach your quarterback, the guy who is an offensive guru, the guy who actually won the Super Bowl.
But of course, I mean, all of that comes back to the guys that are making the decisions, and we've taken a dive on like who they were and what was going on at the time, and you know, when you have such confusion from the top down, you're going to get these oddly discordant type of arrangements. I mean, we're talking like these times where Jerry Angelo does, you know, steps into the job and he's already got a head coach and then he can't get rid of him because they win. And then, you know, Jim Finks is like getting like railroaded by this George Burns character that's about to live to be 110. And just like, and even then, like they did okay in spite of that. And I guess that's sort of, you know, up to the vicissitudes of being a sports fan. I mean, we're you know, you're designed to fail, and some as we've discussed, close to 10 franchises have done it more hilariously than the Bears. Although I want to add, if the Bengals win this Sunday, that needle moves the Bengals ahead of the Bears, at least in the last 50 years. Because right now the Bears are ahead of the Bengals. Both have two appearances, but the Bears at least have a Super Bowl. So even if the Bengals lose, the Bears are still ahead of them. Even if the Bengals have been a more because they didn't win. But if they win, then they got to move that needle. So, you're subject to the fates. But, man, it's really astonishing how just prosaic some of these cases are.
I think, you know, because he'll do anything for an appearance fee, the Rams should pay Joe Montana to come out for the coin toss just to make Mike Brown pass out. It's like, oh, fuck, it's Montana. We're in the Super Bowl. It's Montana again.
Right, right, because they lost. The only two Super Bowls they lost were to Montana and the Bengals, and by 5 points both times.
He's been the MVP in both. Yes,
and he like upped it one in the second one. Like he made some great throws in the first game. I remember watching that first game, and I think you did too. I think we talked about it. I was kind of rooting for the Bengals. I didn't like Montana, even though they went to Notre Dame. I don't remember from Notre Dame.
I was rooting for the Bengals because I was a kid and I liked their uniforms.
Yeah, like Pete Johnson.
They just switched to the crazy striped helmets.
We talked about that. I didn't even know that.
I had a Ken Anderson jersey. I was wearing it at home.
Yeah. I was a Pete Johnson guy, like that time when they had a first and goal and they couldn't punch it in, and Danny Buns is, tackling that Alexander. I was rooting for the Bengals, but they came back in that game because I rewatched it recently because that's what I do, go down YouTube rabbit holes and like, yeah, the Niners got off to a great start. Bengals fought back, made it a game, but then of course the second 5 point game was a real back and forth, and that was a heartbreak. So yeah, you're right. It's funny. Now they're finally not playing the Niners with Joe Montana, but yeah, if they win, like I said, they move ahead. There are at least 10 teams as bad as the Bears are, that the 10 teams that have had it worse, even just for 50 years.
Yeah. There's a Joe Montana documentary on Peacock, which is actually really good. I didn't have real high hopes for it. And I think it's five episodes. And it's
does it include his SNL skit? It's got
it
to.
Does. He even makes it, without saying it, he makes reference to the fact that there's one particular line that gets repeated to him a lot. And that's, I'm going to upstairs and masturbate. He's really funny in it. Because Joe could be a little.
He had a little bit of Ryan Sandberg in him. He was like an extraordinary athlete that really wasn't that interesting, but he's been interesting enough.
So there's a lot of his wife in it. And Jennifer, who is.
Right. She was a swimsuit model for SI. Right, when there's a famous. The year they did the athletes' wives. Yeah,
there's a famous Schick commercial that he did that she's in. And that was when they met. And she's joking about the fact, you know, she looked almost exactly like Christie Brinkley. Almost exactly.
Yeah, knockout.
She's beautiful. And she's got to be, what, in her 60s? Other than the fact that she's got a weird haircut right now. She's great, still a great looking woman. But she joked about how here was this. He'd won the Super Bowl the year before. In fact, they joke about that he had gotten hurt in a playoff game against the Redskins, and the Niners didn't come back and win the game. And it was the only reason they filmed this commercial on Super Bowl Sunday. And the only reason Joe was in it was because he wasn't in the Super Bowl, and that's where he met his wife. And at the end of the commercial shoot, she's like, he very clearly wanted to ask me out, but he was too nervous to do it. And she's like, I'm thinking, this is the guy who won the Super Bowl last year with the 49ers?
Right.
So she basically finished the sentence for him, and they went out. And they ended
up. Right. Nice.
You get a lot of Huey Lewis is in the documentary because, and I knew this as a kid, Dwight Clark and Huey Lewis, or Dwight Clark, Joe Montana, I think Ronnie Lott and somebody else are the chorus on the Huey Lewis and the News song Hip to Be Square.
What?
It's in the liner notes. I remember somehow I saw it as a kid.
When we resume the Cubs wheel and it does fall in one of our favorite years, 1984, I'm going to mention it now as a placeholder. I'll mention it, of course. I'll definitely mention it when it happens. On opening day, 1984, the Cubs opened the season on the West Coast, which hardly ever happens, in Candlestick Park. In 1984, and I stayed home from school to watch it and record it. And the Star Spangled Banner was sung by Huey Lewis in the News. Cubs Giants.
Belichick has a funny line in it because he gets interviewed because the Niners and the Giants met in the playoffs like three times.
Lot.
I think they played the famous Jim Burt game where he almost killed Joe.
And that was like 80s. They met in 80, like 84, 85, 87, 80. They met, like, it's uncanny how often.
Well, and the year
met.
They were going to, the Niners were going for their third straight Super Bowl championship.
In 1990.
Joe broke his thumb. Correct. In the game.
Yep.
Steve Young came in, and all they had to do was run the clock out, and they were gonna go, and Roger Craig fumbled. And the
That's
Giants
right.
kicked field goal and won the game.
They pulled a blur.
So anyway, Belichick's talking about it, and he's like, yeah, you go out to San Francisco, and yeah, for you have to listen to Huey Lewis in the News sing the national anthem, and that puts everybody in a bad mood before the game even starts. I thought it was pretty funny. And then another thing, I put it in the newsletter because I thought it was interesting, because now I can't help but notice it. We see the highlights all the time. When you see the you're going to see it a million times in the run-up to Sunday's game. You're going to see the highlights of the drive against the Bengals. And everybody knows the famous, hey, that's John Candy
story. Yeah.
And Harris Barton tells it and tells why Joe did that, because Harris was like hyperventilating. He was so nervous in the huddle, Joe decided he needed to do something funny to calm Harris down.
Wow.
Joe's uniform doesn't match everybody else's. The stripes on the sleeve are too far apart, and the font on Montana on the back is different. And the reason is his wife packed in his bag the jersey he wore when they won the Super Bowl against the Dolphins and told him to wear it.
That would be Super Bowl 19, January of 1985.
So he wore that jersey. He actually won two Super Bowls in that jersey. But the Niners had changed the design just enough that it's noticeable.
3 years apart.
So when you see that, you're going to notice that Montana is in sans serif, and everyone else on the team has a serif font for their name.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'll probably dial that up, because like I said, during this football season, I've gone down the YouTube rabbit hole, and it would be known as Super Bowl 24 or 23, the 1988 season in which Montana led them on a rally, is one of the very few Super Bowls from that era that was actually a good game, as we've discussed, because the NFC was so goddamn good that they would win by four touchdowns. So that's one of the few. And, of course, it was Montana that fished it out. Montana's other three – well, he had to beat the Bengals twice, and the other two were both blowouts. And almost every other Super Bowl in the 80s was a blowout. So,
yeah, and it starts back in Monongahela,
Pennsylvania.
And how he almost quit football because he thought he was a better basketball player than a football player. And then gets recruited in Notre Dame by Era and is eighth string.
I didn't know that he was recruited by Era, but he played for Dan Devine.
And then Dan Devine comes and didn't think much of Joe.
No shit.
And it took a bunch of injuries to get Joe in the lineup. And Dan kept trying to not play him. It was kind of a Tom Brady, Lloyd Carr thing.
Yeah.
And then ended up winning the national championship with him.
He did. Yeah, Cotton Bowl over Texas and Earl Campbell, I want to say.
And then he was a third-round draft pick. But it does sound like Bill Walsh kind of knew what he got. It was not a, hey, we'll draft this guy and hopefully he'll turn out. Walsh had zeroed in on him, as that was the guy they wanted, and that was the round they thought they could get him in.
Right, even though on January or whatever, December 30th, 1977, Bill Walsh was on the Stanford sideline as Burt Reynolds and Tom Brookshire and Pat Summerall were calling that game. Yeah.
So maybe it must have been that Bill knew when he took the job.
No, that was 70. You're right.
I think they talk about it. About how
that was 77 when Walsh was still at Stanford. 78. I know this. This is the year that 78 was the year that Montana led the comeback over Earl Campbell in Houston. I'm pretty sure it was the Cotton Bowl. And then Montana was drafted, but not until the third round. And then I think Walsh's first year was 80. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So
that would be another Brady Belichick parallel where they showed up at the same time.
Yeah.
Of course, then Walsh was, you know, he was fascinated by Steve Young. Coming out of college in the USFL, he wanted so bad. And Joe kept getting hurt.
And so they went
and got Young, and Bill kept trying to replace Joe.
Young had such a long career.
And it was funny because Bill said, and people thought it was ridiculous at the time, Bill would tell people, I have the two best quarterbacks in the NFL. Why wouldn't I go with the younger one? And they're like, Steve Young is not the best quarterback in the NFL, blah, 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 blah. And of course, by the time they hand the reins over, he fills in for Joe when Joe gets hurt 1 year and wins the MVP.
Is that right?
With Joe still on the team, Steve Young is the MVP.
I didn't know that. What year are you talking? Wow. So. Because Young himself didn't actually like get his due until he was able to really shake Montana off. And
well, then the whole thing was because they lost to the Cow.
And Walsh was gone.
They lost the Cow. They lost the playoff game when Joe was hurt. Then when Joe was gone, they lost to the Cowboys. And the whole idea was Steve couldn't win a Super Bowl. And
he got
to the Super Bowl, and then he.
Seifert intentionally
left him in to throw a 6-touchdown pass because Joe had the record of 5.
Got it.
We get all that stuff.
You mean in the Stan Humphrey Super Bowl? Yeah. Okay. 1990, January of 95. Okay. Yeah, because, of course, and you already know it because you mentioned Seifert. That was long after Walsh was gone because he retired after that fucking Super Bowl.
After the Bengals game, he cries in the locker room. Brent asks him. No, Bob Costas asks, because NBC. Bob Costas asks him, is this the last game in the career of Bill Walsh? And Bill starts crying.
Yeah.
And then he ends up going to Stanford and costing Notre Dame two national championships.
Right, right. Yeah, because Jerome Bettis chose to have his worst game as a collegiate in 92. You know. So.
All right. Well, that's it. That's ended up.
Good.
About Bears coaches and ended up talking about Joe Montana for 10 minutes.
But. Right. Well, it seems to be the direction we go. I'm just happy to take off this Russ Grimm sweater because I'm dying.
You'll call George McClaskey and tell him. I can't wait to work with him. It's going to be great. What a nice lady old Vag is. He probably called her that, and that's why he didn't get the job.
Right. Yeah, a little messed up, or he just spilled fondue cheese on her dress. Somehow.
Yeah, it was fun and maybe a little scary to go back and dig up all of the candidates.
I appreciated the
stuff
exercise.
I did not know. I didn't remember the Jeff Tedford thing. I didn't remember.
Oh, yep.
I didn't know the George Allen thing until I read it, and it made perfect
either.
Sense to me. I'm like, of course, Allen. Yeah. I'm sure George tried to get the job after every Bear coach left.
Yeah,
he wanted to be, you know. I'm surprised he never was the Bear coach.
Well, you know, that's the origin story of George Allen. It was that he thought he was primed to be Halas's successor, and honestly, he probably should have.
Yeah,
for all of his faults, he was a great coach. And instead, he was forced off the pay because Halas was obviously an incredibly exceptional and accomplished human being on so many levels. He had his flaws because he was human, probably not the greatest parent, or because he didn't raise a son that like was even close to it. He sucked up all the DNA, and he was too proud to give some control to Allen, and but it is funny that he comes wandering down the nursing home hallway to hire Ditka, and it just happened to work out. Yep. Thank God it did.
I mean, you can see why, given the stories we told about George and the thing, like there's great NFL films about George Allen. You could see why Halas never hired him because Halas was still going to run the team. George was going to be a complete pain in the ass.
He was
a
conniver.
Deal with that shit. Yeah.
He was a conniver. He was he had angles, which is not bad. I mean, these are qualities that in certain arenas make you successful, and it made Allen successful.
Well, I mean, we told the story about the Blitz and the Wranglers trade everything for each other, and the Wranglers leave. Stuff they just assume is going to be there in Chicago for them. Yeah, they leave the chalkboards and the chalk and the film machine, all that stuff. They get to Chicago, and George has packed all of it up and taken it to Arizona.
He left nothing.
He took every stitch of everything.
No. And he was in his 60s then. He was still thinking that like that. So, yeah, missed opportunity, obviously. That's how it goes. But, almost a Buddy Ryan vibe, although Ryan was never a great coach. George Allen trying to be a really good head coach. I mean, he was a leader. He was successful. But, yeah, so going as far back as the early 60s, George Halas was making missteps. But he lucked out on his last one about, 18 months before he croaked.
But somewhere there's a parallel universe where the Bears go from Buddy Ryan to Johnny Roland. To Joe Pendry, to Ralph Friedgen.
Oh my God!
I don't even know who they would have picked that year. It was all duds on that. This search.
Yep.
Daryl Bevel.
Yeah.
To
right,
Mike Singletary. Just,
yeah, we missed out on
to,
that.
To Matt Nagy.
Yeah.
They still would have hired Nagy, no matter what. We couldn't have avoided that. We were stuck with him.
Well, just hoping that this current low point really is one, but I guess we'll see.
There's always optimism.
That's why
Matt
we
Eberflus,
tune
in. The H is for effort. The I is
really never. Yeah. Coming in with the acronyms and the alphabetisms. Come on.
But the scary thing about that is there's a reason coaches do that, because they work. Like if you actually and Hitz is actually. When he's not trying to over-explain it, it does make sense. All it's hustle, intensity, take care of the ball, and I always forget what S is. I can never remember what S is.
Right.
But they said the Colts
shit,
players actually, like, that's the thing. Even with him gone, they're still going to talk about it.
Yeah. If you're trying to teach, trying to coach, try to keep it simple, in bite sizes, make it deliverable.
I mean, in reality, the key to the Eberflus hire is going to be not even him. It's going to be Luke Getsy. It's going to be the offensive coordinator.
You're right.
If that guy builds a coherent offense around Fields, then Eberflus is going to have the defense taken care of. The Bears are going to be pretty good.
Yeah.
If Getsy doesn't build a good offense, Eberflus isn't going to know how the fuck to build one on his own, and it's not going to work.
And then we get to have another episode where we get to review the candidate.
And then
so
we'll be like,
it's kind of a win.
Remember that the Bears,
right? Kind of a win-win for us.
Do you know that they interviewed 13 coaches and they ended up with?
Right. You know, they went 15 years without a general manager. Some unique qualities.
All right. Well, I think we're back to baseball now. Even though baseball doesn't want to come back to us, I think we're going back to baseball.
I don't know what the crossover is. I think we do have some distinct listeners that are in one camp and not the other. But, yeah, for those of you that are in both,
We'll have to send up the signal that we'll be back to right. We might not spin the wheel right away, but we'll be back to finish up the all of the seasons we still have left with.
Yeah, we're about a third of the way through, so maybe we can slog through. God help us.
All right. Well, someday we could do one of these with Cubs managers. That'll be even worse than this.
Right. That would be like some Andy Warhol, like experimental 6-hour film length. So.
All right. Well, thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Andy.
Many of us have herpes.